You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Thank you very much for coming to Carnegie this afternoon. I'm Jim Collins. I run the Russia-Eurasia program for the Carnegie Endowment. And we have this afternoon another in our series of speakers whom we invite to help the Russian policy or the American policy community understand from firsthand some of the dimensions of the American relationship with some key countries in Russia and Eurasia. And this afternoon, it's my great pleasure to welcome our distinguished guest, the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Georgia. Minister Vishadze has been Georgia's foreign minister since December 2008, I understand. And he is in Washington on this occasion for meetings that have now concluded to launch the formal work of the bilateral U.S.-Georgia Committee on Strategic Cooperation. From what I've read, the meetings of the committee and its working groups covered a really very broad range of questions, really the full agenda of our relations, including economic, security, and defense cooperation, as well as questions about democracy promotion and exchanges of people. These meetings are designed and have been designed to put some flesh on the skeleton of the strategic charter that was signed by our two governments in January. And they represent a strong symbol of American interest and support for Georgia as an independent, secure, and prosperous member of the international community. From remarks the minister made at the State Department yesterday and about these talks, I understand they've opened a new chapter in our relations, and I look forward to hearing his perspective on the visit. So let me give the floor to Minister Vishadze. He'll speak for about 20 minutes, and then we can have a discussion with the minister who will be with us and can answer questions or discuss anything that's on your mind. So, Mr. Minister, the floor.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for this possibility to address you. It is a pleasure for me to be here today and to talk to an entity which has been promoting peace and democracy and constructive thinking. As we continue to recover from Russia's invasion of my country and its devastating effects, we look at to the active engagement of our friends, allies, and the international community. Here again, Carnegie's role has been central, instrumental to our efforts, and we're guided by the ideas of our friends at Carnegie and elsewhere as we work to establish democracy, freedom, security, and prosperity in Georgia and in the region of the South Caucasus as a whole. Before I speak with you about the principal reason for my visit this week, which is to advance the strategic partnership between Georgia and the United States, I hope you might indulge a brief review out of the goals set by my government and our people since the war of last August. And these are the priorities which our government and our nation is trying to achieve at the quickest pace possible. First of all, to continue to advance democracy, human rights, and the establishment of the effective state institutions. Though we have been having significant progress since 2003, since the Russian Revolution, but we do not think that our goals are achieved and everything has been done. We still have a great deal of work to do. To further our economic development in the midst not only of a global crisis, but of the investment chill that comes with war and Georgian economy, which is not based upon oil, gas, or other materia prima, is heavily dependent upon foreign investment. To continue to work with our friends on how best to peacefully restore our territorial integrity. Fourth, to accelerate our European and Euro-Atlantic integration. And last but not the least, to ensure security for all of Georgia, without which all previous goals are simply impossible to achieve. We all understand in Georgia and hopefully here in the United States that without the assistance and support of the USA, these ambitions would be difficult, if not impossible, to meet. And our relationship with America has been fundamental for Georgia's democratic progress and security. We're certain that a close partnership will help both our nations to reap the benefits of democracy and security in Georgia as well as in the region as a whole. Our certainty in this regard is based on the recent experience. In 1991, after regaining the independence that we have lost in 1801, Georgia entered a decade of internal strife, political and socio-economic instability. Yet, in the past 5 years, we have achieved tremendous success in forming a viable state which would have been impossible without the support, assistance and advice of the United States, a nation that we consider one of our closest and most important allies and quite frequently the only ally. Over the past several years, our nations have been cooperating in various fields of mutual interest, from advancing democracy to fighting international terrorism to promoting Eurasia's energy security. However, what drives our relationship are the values that we share, a commitment to upholding human rights and individual freedoms, preserving the sovereignty of the states, respecting their free choice, and promoting market economy and the rule of law. I believe it was both our firm commitment to these values and our cooperation on key policy matters that allowed our two countries to upgrade relationship to the level of the strategic partnership, which is, the great achievement of our government. This is now evolving from a set of common principles, I mean this international legal instrument charter of USA Georgian charter, is evolving from set of common principles to a full agenda of tangible actions across several areas. The U.S.-Georgia Strategic Charter was signed in January, and the first meeting of the USA-Georgia Commission, which oversees the development of the charter, was held yesterday. I should say it was a great success. We have presented to each other very precise, very concrete measures in different fields of our cooperation, and agreed that the second round will be held somewhere in the end of October, beginning of November in Tbilisi. The Charter is the central framework for an increasingly close partnership to advance democracy and security. And the signing of the Charter, which I had an honor, in January during a challenging time for Georgia, was a clear demonstration that the U.S. would not deviate from its policy of promoting democracy and supporting the sovereignty of its allies. Similarly, Georgia has shown its commitment to our American partner during the most difficult times. We have always supported the USA effort in the fight against terrorism. We have already partnered with the USA in Iraq, and I should say that had not the Russian invasion, we would still have been keeping that brigade in Iraq. And I would like to remind you that Georgia was one of the largest contributors to the coalition forces. Additionally, despite the very fragile security environment in Georgia right now, we made the decision to contribute to the International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan and already did send a company which is closely cooperating with French forces deployed there, and we're going to send a reinforced battalion which is going to serve under American command. As we all know, these past 10 months have been extremely difficult ones for my country, and the interests and values of our nations we share basically have been endangered by Russia. This is why Georgia now more than ever needs the continuous and firm U.S. support. It's absolutely impossible to avoid discussing Georgian-Russian relationships, so I would like to excuse myself for doing that, though I would like to speak more about American-Georgian relationship, but Russia's role is instrumental in the Southern Caucasus. The effects of the Russian-Georgia war have put my country in a very difficult situation, compelling us to stay vigilant against external provocations and threats which are happening daily, while also advancing our reform agenda. This is a monumental task, and we're struggling, actually, to achieve both goals. Yet, despite all the problems caused by Russia, Georgia is committed to its democratic reform efforts, which we know contribute to security and stability in the region. Georgians have always aspired to democracy and peace. In fact, Georgia has chosen democracy as its weapon of resistance against Russian aggression. Our government remains firm in pushing toward with reforms and development. We recognize that many Georgians face real poverty and economic pressure, a fact which is even more exaggerated by the global crisis. Therefore, our government is ready and willing to continue pressing for reforms in all directions, giving to Georgian citizens possibility to self-realization. The second wave of the Rose Revolution, which is aimed at further strengthening the rule of law, increasing political pluralism, and bolstering freedom of expression, is our answer to the challenges we face in the aftermath of Russian aggression. The effect of our political pluralism is evident in Parliament, in the media, and quite often on our streets, noisy streets as well. Today, the opposition parties play a greater role in the processes of parliamentary governance and decision-making. The participation of the opposition in our constitutional, judicial, and justice system reform efforts has been further encouraged and increased. Civilian control of our defense and security sector is there, which also contributes to greater political pluralism and transparency. We are introducing jury shortly. Judges are going to be designated for life terms. Opposition parties are directly financed from the state budget. And there is a constitutional commission where all parties are mostly welcomed to discuss how and when this constitution shall enter the force and include all the political forces not represented currently at our parliament. At the same time, we're firmly convinced that sheer will is not sufficient to further advance our democratic reforms. Security and stability of the rest of Georgia is a decisive factor to this end. To pursue our goal of building a strong, enduring, and democratic state that is at peace with its neighbors, we're actively cooperating with international organizations that share this vision. Moreover, Georgian government is determined to stay firm on the economic development track. Despite the heavy burden of aftermath of the Georgian-Russian war and the global economic crisis, we intend to carry our policies that support our market economy, a favorable investment climate, and very importantly, maintain a reliable energy corridor in order to contribute to European energy security. In the midst of all our efforts, and allow me to say this bluntly, Russia is seeking to crush Georgian statehood, which is absolutely unacceptable for our neighbor. A state, I should note, I mean Georgia, that is based on liberal democratic values, a state ready and prepared and willing to maintain good relations with all its neighbors, to take into account neighbors' interests, in parallel to integrating into family of the democratic and liberal states. Russia's actions reveal its belief that having a democracy at its borders is an obstacle to realizing control over its so-called zones of privileged interests, end of quote. That Georgia is setting a very bad example for other CIS countries, and absence of corruption in Georgia is more dangerous than NATO tanks at Russian borders. The Russia-Georgian war did not begin and end in August of 2008. It was just one episode of 18 years declared war against Georgian statehood. The conflict between our two states actually started when the Soviet Union fell and erupted into violence in the early 90s, when Russia placed Georgia's Abkhazia and Tskhinvali region under its control. This is when Russia's policy of the creeping annexation of Georgian territories began, and where a term of controlled conflicts was introduced into Russian political vocabulary. This is when Russia's policy of the creeping annexation began, and every phase of this war since then has been accompanied by brutal and deliberate ethnic cleansing committed by Russia as a policy tool to achieve its goals in the region. Georgian territories literally have been cleansed of ethnic Georgians, and now they have been cleansed of the core population. The tactic of passportization, whereby Russian passports are distributed forcibly and on a massive scale, allowed Moscow to claim that its interference in Georgia stemmed from its obligation to protect Russian citizens. This exact excuse was voiced to justify last August's invasion, just another hot phase of the Russian-Georgian war. In the modern interdependent world, where wars are supposed to be a thing of the past, it's unfortunate that Russia, a country with great potential, with which Georgia shares religion, history, and culture, and a country which could be a leader working towards peace and development on a global scale, is preoccupied with committing military aggression and occupation of parts of another and very small sovereign state. Russia obviously didn't achieve its goal last August because, despite the disturbing effects of the conflict, Georgian statehood is very much alive. Our democracy continues to evolve, and country's eagerness to become part of the Western institutions is stronger than ever. What remains alarming is that Russia's unfinished business leaves substantial room for Georgia's insecurity. This is especially so in light of Russia's significant military buildup in Georgia's occupied territories, a situation aggravated by the fact that there is currently no mechanism in place to defend my country's sovereignty and statehood. I would like to remind you that there are now more than 15,000 well-armed Russian occupiers in those two occupied regions, ready to strike at any time, not to mention the illegal armed groups essentially serving under Russian command, four military bases being under construction, and Gudauta military base fully operational, though it should have been closed since 1999. The infrastructure for Russia's permanent military presence, including land, air, and naval bases, is being constructed in the occupied regions, and they are basically 40 kilometers away from our capital. The illegal armed units of the puppet regimes and their Russian allies undertake constant military provocations aimed at the further escalation of tensions. The increased military presence today will enable Russia to inflict a deadly blow much faster than last August, and efforts of creating some kind of pretext for such invasion is daily there. I would like to mention that we have lost 14 policemen since December to March, killed by sniper fire. One of those policemen, God bless his soul, was killed right in front of European Union's monitoring missions observers. Frankly speaking, and this is clearly understood by my government, Russia poses an existential threat to Georgia. In those 20 years since the end of the Cold War, Russia has continued to cling to its former satellites, attempting to maintain its spheres of influence and trying to reassert its hegemony over neighborhood to realize unclear political and economic interests in the Black Sea and Caspian region, as well as in Central Asia and Europe as a whole. And this unclearness of political objectives, I should say, has resulted into military presence in Georgia, constant threat to statehood, independent sovereignty and territorial integrity of Georgia, Ukraine, and quite few other former Soviet republics. Please note that Southern Caucasus is one of those critical routes from landlocked Central Asia to Europe, which is instrumental to deliver oil and gas alternative routes to Europe. And Georgia is a cork and bottleneck to that alternative route. Through its actions in Georgia, Russia has been attempting to maintain an energy monopoly in the region. This, in turn, allows Moscow to earn substantial income in order to feed its internal political goals and to maintain leverage when it comes to international negotiations. Russia doesn't hide that it will use force to ensure its energy monopoly over Caspian and Central Asian energy resources, something which is clearly stressed in new and the latest national security strategy of the Russian Federation. And Russian aggression in August also shows that Moscow is ready to halt democracy in its so-called zone of privileged interests and cut short the endeavor of its former satellites to join Western structures. As I said, democracy and close ties with the Western institutions at its borders equates for Russia to the West breathing down its neck. This is one way for Russia to destroy democracy and project its influence within those zones And also, Moscow wants no international presence at its borders whatsoever. The international monitoring missions, the one that remains at least, I mean, European Union's monitoring mission, continues to be blocked from accessing the occupied territories where coercion, oppression, ethnic cleansing, and mass and gross violations of human rights on a daily basis is a normal and routine phenomenon. The most recent demonstration of Russia's intent was its veto last week of a resolution that would have extended the United Nations observer mission in Georgia, UNOMIC. This in addition to recently blocking the OSCE observer mission, status neutral, actually, which was a heroic result of the heroic efforts of the Greek chairmanship, fully supported by 54 member states of OSCE, leaves Georgia's occupied territories completely in Russian hands. We are hopeful that the European Union's monitoring mission in Georgia will be reinforced and that it will gain access to the occupied territories in order to control and fairly and objectively report to the international community about situation inside those areas. But I shall stress that this is neither Georgian precondition nor this shall be held as a measure of success of this mission. This mission is already successful enough. Ladies and gentlemen, we all understand that international law is the only mechanism to hold states responsible for their actions. All nations, especially those that claim to be reliable actors, ought to hold dear the international laws, norms, and principles, because otherwise there is no chance for stability, security, and well-being of people worldwide. Russia's desire to be seen as an important and trustworthy regional and global player is dubious at its best in light of its continuous breach of the international law, as well as its ongoing violation of all points of the 6-point ceasefire agreement which Russia's president signed last August 12 in presence of President Sarkozy. Russia must be held responsible for its aggressive actions against Georgia and its attempt to forcibly and illegally hold the reins in its so-called zone of privileged interests, not only for the sake of allowing freedom and democracy to flourish in Southern Caucasus and to ensure stability and security in the region as a whole, but more importantly for making certain that the suffering undergone by the citizens of Georgia during the Russia-Georgia war is not felt by people elsewhere. We therefore need to address Russia's increasingly aggressive policy in a swift and resolute manner in order not to lose the gains obtained after the Cold War. There are two ways for a state to ensure its national security. On one hand, it can employ its own capabilities, and on other, it can look to the international community for support. An international mechanism is critical to ensure security in Georgia because it would be a Herculean and nearly impossible task for my country to confront Russia or to secure one's stability alone. Our effort to join Western structures derives from exactly this notion and is based upon the shared values and principles that Georgians hold very dear. European and Euro-Atlantic integration remains Georgian foreign policy priority, and we're determined to undertake all the necessary steps in order to advance the integration process and comply with required standards. This integration is a natural process for Georgia. It is critical to our country's security and also serves the interest of our allies who seek security and stability more broadly throughout Europe. Georgia by no means wants to import its problems into NATO or other structures. But there is truth in the notion that had Georgia been accepted into NATO, or at least given MEP prior to August, Russian aggression would simply have been deterred and avoided. And let us remain hopeful that the alliance will not let the same thing happen ever again. Georgia greatly appreciates the continuous support of the U.S. for deepening our integration into Euro-Atlantic institutions and enhanced security cooperation between our two countries. Georgia will work without tiring in order to strengthen its candidacy for NATO membership and take full advantage of the annual national plan, which was a wonderful way out from that catch-22 of MEP. With democracy as our weapon, the notion that the strong do what they have to do and the weak accept what they have to accept is a thing of the past, or at least we hope that it is a thing of the past. On the contrary, We measure our strength by the level of our democracy, by efforts to cooperate with the states, all neighbors, towards peace, security, stability, and prosperity. Georgia believes not in zones of privileged interest, but in zones of cooperation, including Russian Federation. We remain hopeful that the international community will firmly stand by Georgia, therefore support freedom, security, stability, and justice, and persuade Russian Federation to participate into this effort. I will never tire in saying how important the U.S. engagement is to Georgia. Our countries are national partners with shared democratic values. Security and spread of democracy stand at the core of our mutual interests. Our common efforts can deter those who want to endanger our freedoms. Georgia's integration into Western institutions will serve as a model for all other states in the region to emulate by choosing freedom over captivity, territorial integrity over territorial problems, security over fear, and cooperation over animosity. With this in mind, I remain very hopeful and optimistic that we are going to have a normal relationship with Russian Federation, and Georgia will transform itself into liberal, democratic, Western-style country. Thank you very much. I have to have a sip of water, and then I'm all yours.
Mr. Minister, you can sit down if you want.
Yes. No, it's easier for a boxing match to.
All right. Well, let's then to have stand some up questions here from the audience. Please identify yourself, and let's put your question. John?
Yes, sir.
John Evans, formerly of the U.S. State Department. Well, thank you.
Does that work?
Yeah. Yep.
Mr. Minister, this is a very interesting statement you made just now. I would not dare to speak for anyone else in the room, but it seems to me that some of us here in the United States might think that the portrait of Russian behavior that you have just given us may be slightly more extreme than our perception. Clearly, there are a lot of problems involved in South Ossetia and Abkhazia. This, as you have said yourself, this did not start in August of last year. This has a long history going back at least to the early 90s and the days of Mr. Gamsakhurdia. I guess my question is that now that you have given us your official statement, can you help us understand a little bit more in a less official way what some of the real local issues are there? Not viewing it just as a Russian attempt to stifle Georgian statehood, but to understand the local politics of South Ossetia and Abkhazia in the current stage. Thank you.
First of all, I would like to say that my official part of my statement and unofficial Q&A session is not going to differ that much, because while taking a decision to come here, naturally, I was prepared to represent my government and expressed my beliefs. I don't think the picture I've described is that extreme, because if you take it from Georgian perspective, and if you remember about this first undeclared and declared war against our statehood, if you remember about close to 400,000 refugees and IDPs, if you remember persons deprived their constitutional right to be owners of the property and or return to their homeland, I don't think the picture I've described is that extreme. This is not, I'm not claiming that Abkhaz and Ossetian attitude to Georgians could have been brighter and better, and that only Russia was inspirator of all the problems. But let's start from the very beginning. For example, the war which started in Skinval region in 1990. As always, it started with killing of an innocent 3-month-old Georgian baby in a village which is called Prisia, and Georgian part of which doesn't exist anymore. When country is collapsing, the Soviet Union, when, just remember, please, 1990, when no state structures function normally, when the society is absolutely totally lost, not understanding where they are heading to, and their normal day-by-day life is distorted, these kind of facts normally start much bigger problems. Do you remember Sumgayit, sir? Do you remember those 30 corpses which came out from nowhere, and which started basically the war which we still know, and which is called Karabakh? So I'm not even speaking about the sources of this problem. I'm speaking about constant attempts of Russia to stop Abkhaz and Ossetians talking to Georgians face to face. I'm speaking about constant inflow of arms and mercenaries into those regions until 2008, and with so-called peacekeepers who are basically training the local bands, and then the open military aggression against Georgia. I'm speaking about total reluctance of letting international peacekeeping or executive police operation into those territories. And I speak about reluctance to accept all our peace proposals, last of which I've delivered myself to Moscow on June 22nd, and which did consist, and actually I should say that visit helped me to get rid of every illusion I had previously. You know that I am a Russian citizen too, and I spent all my life in Russia, and I returned to Georgia only in 2005. So if somebody thinks here that it gives to me tremendous pleasure to speak about Russia the way I have to speak right now, is grossly mistaken. I'd rather be standing here and speaking about a great Russian culture and my mastery of the Russian language, which I'm very proud of. But this is facts of life. And I delivered myself that peace initiative to Russians and proposed to them creation of joint Russian-Georgian Commission for Economic Rehabilitation of Abkhazia, joint Georgian-Abkhaz administration and police for Gali and Ochamchiri, legal status, real legal status for Russian troops to stay there as a peacekeepers, free economic zone in Gali and Ochamchiri region, free railway passage from Moscow to Yerevan through Abkhazia, Georgia, Tbilisi, Georgia proper, Tbilisi, and then to Yerevan, which is in everybody's interests. And I can go on constantly. There was more than 25 clauses in that proposal. And we got blunt yet from that. So I'm not trying to describe a picture worse than it is, actually. Because if you face the facts, how you're going to describe the situation where you've got third wave of ethnic cleansing in August of 2008. 20% of the country is occupied. Property of IDPs and refugees and state property is constantly under privatization and goes to Russian Federation's private and corporate investors. Georgian language is under ban in Gali. In the schools, they cannot have education in Georgian. There is forcible passportization and conscription going. All passages are now sealed by Russian FSB border troops. And you have five illegal military bases on your territory. If there is a possibility to argue with those facts and present it to me as something which needs more, let's say, objective and calm attitude. Let us hear those arguments, but I don't see any, quite sincerely. Thank you. Other questions?
Let me ask a question of you, Mr. Minister. Could you say a word or two about Georgia's relations with Armenia and Azerbaijan?
What's
happening to regional cooperation or regional enmity in the Caucasus?
Very interesting question and very useful one. I should say, first of all, that Georgia-Azerbaijan relationship is absolutely exemplary. We're strategic partners. We participate together in all regional programs. I'm not mentioning those two pipelines, you know, everything. We are building up the new railway, which will tie Turkey, Georgia, and Azerbaijan into one net and give us access to Central Asia and farther and to Europe from that side. Our relationship is on a very solid legal base. We have bilateral instruments nearly in every aspect of our cooperation. Armenia, though we cannot call our relationship strategic partnership, and this is understandable why, I am very proud to say that this government and the Armenian government, this minister and my colleague, were working absolutely without tiring to bring Georgian and Armenian relationship where they belong. We have improvement nearly in every aspect of our relations. We are accustomed to a notion that we shall take each other's interests into notion. And for example, when Russians proposed to us to open passage Kazbekia-Perlarsia, which is the only legal passage from Georgia to Russia, we accepted that proposal and expressed readiness to start negotiations, keeping in mind, first of all, Armenia's economic interests. The relationship with Turkey is very much the same as with Azerbaijan. Mm-hmm. And I should say that it is in Georgia's best interest to incorporate and include Armenia in all regional programs we have. The quicker this is going to happen, the better for the whole Southern Caucasus and all three nations there. So we are not having any problems. I mean, when you have two or three or four sovereign states in a region, you're always going to have questions to each other. It's normal. It's the same thing as you're dealing with Mexico, say, or Canada. But our cooperation, our relationship is free of animosity and is full of understanding that it shall be based upon the compromises. Okay. That's how we are dealing with our immediate neighbors.
Okay. Steve?
Yeah, Steve Piper from Brookings. Mr. Minister, a question regarding your relations with some of the major European countries, Germany, France, Italy, which were ones reportedly that were most reluctant at Bucharest to go forward with the membership action plan for your country and for Ukraine, and also I think countries where there were questions about some of the decisions made in Tbilisi in October of 2008. I wonder if you just comment.
November, you mean, sir?
Sorry?
November.
No, October. August.
August.
But my question would be, how are the relations now going between Tbilisi and those countries? Are you able to sort of move towards a situation in which you can look to those countries for more support in terms of your engagement with the European institutions? And what are some of the problems in those relationships?
Thank you for your question, sir. You know, we want to become member of NATO. NATO has a charter, and NATO has members, and NATO has standards. It does not irritate us and does not surprise if, for example, Germany or France have some kind of skepticism toward it. It's our task to prove to them that we are up to those standards. And it's a normal thing. When you're trying to become a monk within an order, you shall abide to a charter. And the same applies to Georgia and our aspirations towards NATO. We are having excellent relationship with Germany and France. We're working together to restore our territorial integrity with only peaceful means. We have excellent cooperation within the United Nations, and I shall stress that the fact that we unfortunately couldn't save the mission but managed to put the blame exactly where it belongs, tribute for that goes to France and to Germany at a very great extent, to the United States, of course, and Great Britain. Every government has a constitutional right to have their own opinion upon decisions of another government. And then we shall sit down and without emotions try to prove our case to each other. I don't know which part of our decisions our German colleagues or French colleagues didn't like, and I do not want to guess. But if your question implies that we have started the August episode of that war, excuse me, sir, I can't accept that, because on the 1st of August, and I was deputy minister, and I thought that upon request of my president, I am returning to the Ministry for Foreign Affairs just for 6/8 months to try to improve our relations with Russia. And quite sincerely, had I been knowing what I am involving myself into, I wouldn't accept that proposal. On the 1st of August, I started getting intelligence information from France, from our intelligence sources, from Ministry of Interior and our intelligence service, that Georgian enclaves are heavily bombarded. And all those cannons and artillery systems are stationed right in the middle of Skin Valley. On the 2nd, I have a flood of this information. I've been getting emails and cables and phone calls nearly every 10 minutes. And it was going on this way until August the 4th, when as a normal former Soviet citizen, which doesn't believe anybody other than his own eyes, I have taken my Russian passport, private car, private driver, and crossed, because my driver is from so-called South Ossetia. He's half Ossetian, half Georgian. And I've crossed administrative border at a place where we knew there are not going to be any Russian troops or Ossetian troops. And I managed to get to a Georgian village, Nuli, which existed no more. Only stroke house and dogs were running in a village which used to have 2,000 of population, and all houses were torched, and not torched deliberately, but bombarded. I tried to enter another village, which was called Amnevi, and I couldn't manage that because it was encircled by somebody dressed in a neat military form. So I'm not going to speculate on that they were Russians, but it was a Russian military form, and clean one, an orderly one, not like what those bandits are dressed up normally. On the 5th, I came back, and on the 5th, the whole diplomatic corps presented in Georgia, including all the ambassadors, were delivered to those enclaves, and they have seen everything themselves. And we've been telling to everybody since February, myself, and I'm ready to provide readouts, and actually I will ask those ambassadors to provide those readouts to you if they accept. But we've been telling to them that we are on the brink of the war. Do something. So, do I have irritation when somebody asks me this question? No. Am I able to prove my case? I'm trying my best. Do I sincerely believe what I'm saying to you? Yes, after seeing those torched Georgian villages, no doubt. And actually, one more thing. Early morning on the 7th, I get information from 3 different sources about Rocky Tunnel being jammed by tanks, armored personnel vehicles, and armed forces of Russia entering the place, which, by the way, have been confirmed afterwards by many respected Russian independent politologists. I have written myself, it was 8 a.m., I have written the statement of the Ministry for Foreign Affairs, which said, that above information provided by different sources, etc. And at 6 p.m. of that day, Georgian villages were heavily bombarded. By president's instruction, I basically became acting minister, and then I have discovered that nothing worked at my ministry. Internet was out, mobile phones were out. The only thing which did work was a special governmental service. God bless it, because this was the only communication with between the agencies and with the outside world. And then the mayhem started. So if French and Germans are asking me this question, and they did many times, and there are different Germans and French officials, they have different beliefs. It's, you know, this is democracy. Everybody is entitled to believe what they would like to believe. But one fact is clear. We fought that war on Georgian territory, and the 20%, which is currently under occupation, that's Georgian territory, and nobody is going to argue with that. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Don?
Thank you, Mr. Minister. Don Jensen, Johns Hopkins University. I wanted to move our attention a little bit north and to the east and ask you about the situation from Tbilisi's point of view of the North Caucasus, where during the height of the Chechen War, it seemed to be some spillover into Pankisi and elsewhere. And if anything, the region seems to have been gotten more unstable. The governor of Ingushetia was in a bombing incident this week. Can you give us Georgia's perspective about the events there? Does it affect, has it affected recently Georgia's own foreign policy aspirations or domestic politics?
Thank you, sir. Now, can I comment on this as a Russian citizen? Not as the Minister for Foreign Affairs of Georgia, because otherwise it's interference in a sovereign state's internal affairs, and I wouldn't like to do so. Problem is that, to put it bluntly, Russia will never solve these problems without Georgia's cooperation. And God save us, if something happens to the Northern Caucasus, we are going to suffer the first, together with Russia. So what's going on there, this is an explosive mixture of different things, of unemployment, of total deprivation of any perspective, nationalism, arbitrary actions of the Russian military forces and police, Islamic fundamentalism, just name it. Everything is there. And I think that creating a dictator like in Chechnya and giving to them full power over the lives, thoughts, existence, and property of subjects is no way out. As Ingushetia's example and attempt on Evkurov, their president, shows, every killed so-called partisan will be substituted by three. You see, the Russian Federation, Kremlin said that counter-terrorist operation is over. The moment they said it's over, the whole series of killing of high-ranking Russian officials, local officials, followed immediately. Now, I don't want Northern Caucasus to be in trouble or to explode, neither as Russian citizen nor as the Minister for Foreign Affairs of Georgia. And had there be a goodwill between two our countries, we would be prepared to cooperate in every field. Pankisi Gorge, by the way, was grossly exaggerated by Russians as a propaganda matter, but it indeed had certain militants there. Now it's absolutely, totally cleansed off, and even more so, Chechen refugees headed themselves elsewhere. Most of them are now in European countries with documents issued either by OSCE or the United Nations, and Georgian government is prepared to take monitors and observers to that place anytime. And actually our border between Georgia and Russia, besides those occupied territories, is guarded quite well. So infiltration from our side, first of all, there is nobody to infiltrate, and second, had there been somebody to infiltrate, it would be absolutely impossible. And if there is an urgent task for Kremlin, I think that there are a lot of urgent tasks, one of those tasks is to take care of Northern Caucasus as quick as possible. Otherwise, it will explode the whole region.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am.
Nina Japetidze, Georgian Association. You've mentioned about Georgia's integration into NATO and Euro-Atlantic Alliance and European Union, and our association is a great supporter of this dream, and we have many friends in the United States along with other diaspora organizations that would love to see Georgia as member of NATO, and we do not believe that membership of Georgia in NATO is something that Russia should be concerned about, because having an additional member like Georgia in NATO does not equal anti-Russian sentiment on the side of NATO alliance at all. However, as you know, for a country to become a member of NATO, it's important to have as close as possible of an ideal human rights record. And unfortunately, recently, facts that we hear reported by Georgia's Ombudsman's Office or Human Rights Watch are concerning us. And we were wondering, what is the government of Georgia doing to try to encourage a positive content in the assessments of human rights record in Georgia and diminish the kind of criticism that we recently are hearing? If you don't mind answering that question. Thank you.
Thank you. First of all, I would strongly advise to rely upon different sources, to use governmental sources, Ombudsman's Office, and independent sources. Now, facts are quite simple. Since April 9, citizens of Georgia extensively used their constitutional right to freedom of assembly. And government was defending this right. There was no police in the site, and they have closed streets of capital for nearly 3 months. Now, if this is not standard of democracy, I don't know what is. Please do try to close street in Washington, D.C. And then I will see what's going to happen. Now, we learned our lessons. We learned our lessons from November of 2008. So when non-parliamentary opposition declared that they are going to hold constant manifestations, we said, fine. It's enshrined in our constitution. You can have freedom of assembly, you can have freedom of speech, and it's our task to defend you. And it doesn't matter how many manifestators are out there. If there are just five of them, it's already a voice of dissent and dissatisfaction. And it's our task to take those people out from the streets, give them jobs and guarantees of decent life. And trust me, ma'am, I'm not going to claim that we are exemplary democracy, but we're trying our best. And we're trying our best and our hardest. Just think about 4.5 million population of this country, of our country, which is in the midst of global economic crisis and fighting aftermath of Russian-Georgian war. We're doing our best, what we can. But I can promise to you one thing. There is never going to be violence against demonstrators. And if responsible part of non-parliamentary opposition wants to join the process of power sharing, we're prepared to do so. And some of them already did, actually. Some of those meetings are conducted in a peace and quiet. Some of them are widely publicized. But that process is already going on. And being a Georgian, you know that amount of manifestators fell drastically, and on a daily basis, you can hardly find 5,000, maybe 1,000 people in the streets. And the normal traffic has been resumed. And I should say we all went out from this difficult situation as a winners. Because for me as a citizen of Georgia, the first fantastic thing was that opposition and the government alike refused to use force and to recur to the violence. So we have passed certain exam to maturity. Thank you.
Okay. Ma'am.
Madam.
You had a question. You.
Actually, you have already answered my question, Excellency. I just wanted to make then some short remark regarding Georgian-Armenian relationship. Just remind you that we are waiting for a visit of President Saakashvili, and probably that will be an opportunity for two presidents to reconsider the level of our relationship.
You know, I can promise to you one thing, that strategic relationship between Georgia and Armenia, and something which is going to be legally enshrined into a bilateral agreement and labeled as a strategic partnership, is one of my priorities, together with my good friend and colleague, Eduard Nalbandian. So eventually, trust me, we're going to reach that goal. Other questions?
Could I ask
yes, sir.
Maybe the last question if we don't
We still have 20 minutes, and yeah. I have a plane to catch.
You spent, a couple of days in this capital, and you have gone through the first round of talks on the Strategic Commission. I wonder if you could give us a sense of where you would hope to see results by October when you have the next meeting. I mean, are there particular things that the committees came up with and that we might watch for in the U.S.-Georgia relationship? Mm-hmm. And a sense of where you think this practical side will be going.
Thank you for your question. First of all, I would like to remind to this distinguished audience that we had working groups dedicated to democracy, to security, to trade economy, and to people-to-people. Georgian side and American side did present very precise and specific proposals about each of those fields, mm-hmm. measures which shall be taken, and international instruments which we would like to have ready in the near future. It's absolutely impossible to have any of those drafts in October, because we just learned intentions and plans of each other. But October will be a real start when it comes to drafting process. Where I would like to see quick progress, I would say in two fields: visa facilitation, visa regime facilitation, and readmission agreement.
Why does that not surprise me?
Yes. And because this is something an ordinary citizen feels immediately. Mm-hmm. And we both understand that visa regime facilitation implies responsibility of readmission, and we're ready for that. And second is relaxed trade regime between our countries, and possibly, deep free trade agreement. Mm-hmm. The United States, we know, do not have any problems with offering to Georgia deep free trade agreement, but during this horrible economic crisis, everybody is afraid to set a precedent for much more stronger players. We'll see how we're going to progress, but there are a lot of will and readiness to work out those drafts and those treaties as quick as possible.
Well, Mr. Minister, I think you've been generous with your time. We'll let you have a few minutes extra to get ready for your airplane.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it.